You're listening to FMGRadio.com. Welcome to Generation Reinvention, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Future, with your host, Brent Green.
Welcome back to Generation Reinvention. Lori Orlov is the founder of Aging in Place Technology Watch. She leads a market research firm that provides thought leadership, analysis, and guidance about technologies and related services that enable boomers and seniors to remain longer in their homes of choice. According to Lori, and I quote, "The marketplace for technology to assist aging adults is expected to grow sharply from $2 billion today to more than $20 billion by 2020. The aging of the 78 million baby boomers and increased awareness of technology solutions will drive sales," unquote. In her previous career, Lori spent more than 30 years in the technology industry, including 24 years in IT and 9 years as a leading industry analyst for Forrester Research. While there, she was often the first in the industry to identify technology trends and management strategies which have survived the test of time. She has spoken regularly and delivered keynote addresses for various organizations, including the What's Next conference, which is coming up very shortly. She's been quoted in Business Week, Forbes, Kiplinger, the Toronto Star, and the New York Times. In addition to her technology background and years as a technology industry analyst, Lori served as a volunteer long-term care ombudsman and is certified in geriatric care management from the University of Florida. And she is the author of When Your Parents Need Elder Care. So I'd like to welcome to Generation Reinvention, Lori Orlov.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate talking to you today.
It's a pleasure, and I'm very much looking forward to our conversation, Lori. I'm kind of a technology geek, not as much as perhaps you are, but I love what technology enables us to do. So let me begin kind of getting an understanding of the start of your journey with Aging in Place Technology Watch. What were your overriding objectives when you started the community, if you will, the website and all of the other things that you're doing around this website?
Well, I had been, galvanized into consciousness raised when I was a caregiver for my own mother, who passed away a couple of years ago of Alzheimer's. And while I was still in my other job, I was an IT analyst for Forrester Research. I went part-time for a while and self-published a book on elder care, partly because I was amazed at how a smart, well-educated person like myself could actually be so clueless when it came to caregiving and elder care. So that was my first step. And then in 2007, I resigned from Forrester Research and began Just Contracting. I had been in IT for 24 years. I'd been an analyst at Forrester Research for 9 years. I really thought that was enough of that and enough of IT. And in 2008, with my going to school at the University of Florida part-time on geriatric care management and self-publishing the book, I started blogging in 2008 on the question of technology for older adults. And I was particularly inspired by a report from the White House Conference on Aging published by Joe Coughlin at the MIT Age Lab. And what he wrote in that report was that cathedral builders were wanted in this industry of technology for older adults, and yet what we had was a number of cottage companies. And wouldn't it be great if, in fact, there was an overarching vision for how technology should all work together to help people stay in their homes of choice as long as they could? And that was kind of my trigger. I started blogging, and then I published a market overview in the spring of 2009. Mary Furlong started mentoring me. She runs Mary Furlong & Associates. She told me that I should not publish my market overview until her What's Next event. So So I waited until then. I gave my first speech, and I took on my first client in March of 2009. And I've been doing pretty much that exclusively since. I gave up IT writing in 2010 and have been full-time at this.
Were you trained in IT back in college, or is that something you concentrated on educationally? I'm just curious.
No, I have a bachelor's degree in music.
Yeah.
My very first job it was as a temporary computer operator at IBM in Poughkeepsie, New York, and I began taking programmer aptitude tests around that time. I was dating someone who thought I would make a great programmer, and so I kept taking programmer aptitude tests, and then I got a job in Boston at Teradyne, where the person who hired me had just read a New Yorker article that said there was a correlation between music and programming. And so he hired me and trained me on the job. This is at Teradyne in Boston. He trained me on the job to be a computer programmer. And I stayed in IT for 24 years, rising up to chief information officer in a couple of companies.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I do understand the dots being connected between music aptitude, mathematical aptitude. In fact, I've read that if parents want their children to be good in math, then teach them music if they're so inclined. And then, of course, that relationship to programming. But I remember back in college trying to, struggle through classes in COBOL and the old programming languages. And I was just curious. But I digress. Let's get to the question of technologies, particularly as they pertain to aging. And I'm just kind of curious, what are some of the most exciting areas to you? Because you write about a vast amount of information about what's going on in technology and aging. But I'm curious what you are excited about that is available right now, most immediately available. What's caught your attention of all the things that are going on out there?
Well, I think if you look at what's happening with video and the ability to have video conversations between grandchildren and grandparents, I think that's a pretty exciting change. Excuse me. The percentage of older adults that are now connecting to the internet, that's pretty exciting. The other thing, so back to the grandparents for a moment. One software company that started this past year that I thought was pretty interesting was a company called Readio, R-E-A-D-E-O. And what they created was a website in which the grandchild and the grandparent could both be looking at children's books online at the same time and also seeing video images of each other. So it's sort of beyond Skype. It's applying video to a particular purpose. And apparently, small children will sit in front of children's books a lot longer than they will sit in front of a camera. So I thought that was actually one of the cool ones. The other thing that's happening now that I think is quite interesting, well, there's two aspects to it. One of it is the ability for GPS location identification. So in the past, the traditional personal emergency response button, which is worn by older adults, has only been useful if you press the button within 600 feet of your home. Now, with mobile personal emergency response devices, you can be out and about. And I think the out and about world of being able to also have access, in case you need it, to a call center and the notification of responders, I think that's a big safety change. So things around web cameras and the ability to actually keep in touch with folks when they're out and about, I think, are two aspects of creating a more social life and a more safe life.
Social engagement's critical, and I obviously can see the benefit to grandparents and their grandchildren to remain connected. In fact, I am trying to explore that right now with one of my family members who is not technologically inclined, but wants to be in touch a lot more now because of a family illness. And so this idea of Skype video is, and I'm excited about, Skype now being available on televisions. And I guess that's the next new thing, is to have full Skype video capability on your home television. And that's kind of the direction. I read something about Best Buy now marketing one of those televisions as a priority right now. I'm sure you've picked up on that too.
Yeah, and some new vendors launched at CES, one of them, this company called TeleHD, which would enable people to Skype through their television with a set-top box and no computer. So that, I think, to me, the ability to reduce the reliance on a computer is a positive. That's a feature. So those are, and there's a whole series of caregiving-related websites and what have you that have emerged in recent years, the biggest of which is caring.com, which I'm led to believe has 2 million monthly viewers. So that's really booming right along in terms of helping adult children deal with caregiving issues for their aging parents.
Absolutely. And I've had Andy Cohen on this show and discussed caring.com, and I have recommended it at least to 10 people who are dealing with caregiving from distances and things like that as a tool to help them find resources in their own communities they might otherwise not be aware of. So yes, caring.com is an online play that has been a very successful tech startup in the last few years, and certainly an example of how the internet and web communities can fortify, I guess, our sense of connectivity and therefore greater social engagement, which we generally know, at least in the past, has been a problem for people after a certain age. They start having diminished social networks.
Right.
So let me ask you, look ahead just a few years. I'm going to save, you know, bold forecasts off into the 15-year, 20-year, 25-year horizon for our discussion toward the end of the show. But just looking ahead the next few years, what do you think will be available that's coming through the pipeline that you've seen some information about?
Well, I'm very interested in this platform that Microsoft has launched called Kinect, K-I-N-E-C-T.
Okay.
And Kinect is originally launched as a game environment to be attached to an Xbox 360 game console. Mm-hmm. But what's happened with it is it's become such an interesting concept that all kinds of health and behavioral and fitness applications are being designed for it without requiring the Xbox game console. And it, the most interesting thing about it is it's a device that can actually recognize the user and differentiate the user from another user. So it has a camera in it. It remembers the identity of you, and you can interact with it with hand gestures as opposed to holding a controller or typing or pushing a button. And to me, moving forward, that type of user interface is really going to transform technology for older adults.
It's kind of in the...
You want something you don't have to type.
Right. Is it kind of in the direction of Wii, the interactive game that was introduced a number of years ago?
Right.
Except now it has...
About the Nintendo, yeah, that has a controller.
Yeah.
And if you think about the fact that... the interesting thing about the Nintendo Wii is when it was introduced, there was no anticipation that it would be so popular with older adults. And
right.
It turned out to be extremely popular with older adults, you know, retiree bowling leagues, and it's used in senior housing and all kinds of applications for it. I think the same thing is going to happen with Kinect. It's just been released as part of a new version of Windows. I think it's going to really take off. Now, it won't be taking off with software from Microsoft. It's all the partners that are going to actually write applications for it in the next few years. I would say keep your eye on that.
Okay. In fact, I'd like you to hold that thought. I'd like to get a better understanding of what applications you might expect from Kinect that will aid people in their aging and caregivers who are taking care of parents and older adults. And so what is Kinect going to do? So stick around. We'll be right back and continue our conversation with Lori Orlov.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network. where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
Lori, I'm very intrigued by this idea of Connect. I did read something that you'd written about it, just a brief description of it. And I guess I get it that we'll be able to interact with our computers pretty much physically by movement. I'm also intrigued that it can recognize the difference between me and you standing in front of it. What kind of things do you feel might come forward as a result of this technology, specifically in the age tech area? How will it be applied?
Well, it's certainly being applied in terms of physical therapy and occupational therapy applications. They've already been created, where you move in front of it. Exercise applications have already been created. But one of the other interesting aspects of it, if it knows the difference between you and the difference between me, we can, in fact, not be in the same location. It can basically interact with us across the internet. And so this means that a therapist could potentially guide, a person could interact with a therapist in terms of occupational therapy, getting one's shoulder back in shape possibly after hurting it or whatever it happens to be. The entire experience could be, in fact, distributed across people across the internet. That could be with a therapist, it could be with a doctor. The other thing that is related to that but not exactly the same is when you start thinking about cameras and web cameras and the ability to have remote consultations with doctors so that people don't have to get in their car and go 100 miles to see a specialist, but in fact could have some kinds of consultations through the internet with a camera. I think that's pretty powerful too, and that is already happening in a number of situations where the specialists simply aren't nearby.
So, for example, I could have a specialist in India and I stand in front of my Connect web-enabled camera and say, "Doctor, my right shoulder hurts when I move it like this."
And yes, then he can look at feasible.
And he can reply and say, "Don't move your shoulder like that anymore."
Exactly. That's one way, one aspect of it. The other thing is just with a regular camera attached to a computer, you could hold up your arm and show a doctor who is looking to see if, in fact, your incision is healing from an operation. There's actually even been a robot with a camera environment on it like that that's been invented. It's actually being piloted in Children's Hospital in Boston from a company called Vigo, V-G-O. And Vigo, as a robot, actually moves around the home and into position, or it could move around the hospital with the doctors, and enables a person who doesn't have to come back into the hospital to show that an incision actually is looking pretty good.
Hmm.
So that's another camera-based concept that I think, applied in robots in medical care. Connect in therapy, physical therapy, and occupational therapy, but I think we're going to see many, many applications, and I would keep your eye on it.
Would you kind of classify this as a disruptive technology that a lot of things are going to change because of it?
Yes. If you add, camera-based technologies like Connect or like webcams, if you add that to GPS tracking capabilities and interactive television, I would say those three together are the disruptive changes that will actually create all kinds of applications that will be useful to help us age better and be better caregivers.
Fascinating. I mean, just the implications. One area I'm thinking about is the area of fitness and personal training, where the disruptive physical fitness guru of the future uses the Connect system to provide fitness training to whoever subscribes all over the world simultaneously.
Yep.
It's That's mind-boggling, the potential in that. Well, let me ask you about wearable devices, because we haven't really talked. Well, you've talked about GPS like on the smartphone, but are you seeing development in the area of wearable devices that may have immediate implications?
Well, there's sort of a movement going right now. I don't know if you've heard about it, called the quantified self,
No.
where people are basically wearing certain types of tracking devices. In fact, I'm wearing one right now called a Fitbit. And a Fitbit is a little attachment that I can put attached to my pocket that's close to my body, basically. And it keeps track of my steps, the pace at which I'm going, whether I'm going upstairs or downstairs, my progress over a week in terms of how far I've gone and how many steps I've taken. And it also now, there's an interface for a weight scale to keep track of if I were to have a congestive heart failure or some kind of condition that would cause weight fluctuation. You can also interface a weight scale to it. So I think if you think about the kinds of chronic disease management, telehealth, fitness, there's been a lot of interest in it, and I think it's getting very miniaturized and into little devices like this Fitbit thing that enables incredible applications to be thought up over time that really previously we just didn't have.
Okay, now you call it Fitbit?
Yes, F as in fish, I-T-B-I-T, Fitbit.
And it kind of acts, remember the 10,000-step little digital devices you could put on your belt or something and measure whether or not you made it to 10,000 steps in a particular day. That is local. You read it. It tells you whether or not you did it and how much. This is actually uploaded to the net and connected to other more sophisticated applications measuring your,
right.
I guess you could say, physical output.
Right. Now, you know, locally, just looking at it, I can see that I've only gone up 2 steps today, and I've only burned 903 calories according to this, and it gives me a little flower, and it adds more flowers to the flower if I actually go a longer distance. It tells me how far I've gone. But when I walk near a particular unit in the home where it recharges, when I just walk near that, it uploads the information, and it emails me a report about how I'm doing at whatever frequency I want to see the report. Now, it also has in it the ability, and right now they're not doing anything with it, but it has fall detection capability. And if you think about the reverse of fitness, sort of the decline in activity over time, it could also report that, in fact, my pace is changing over time, and perhaps there's a reason to be concerned. Now, there's no application for this at this point, but I imagine at some point there'll be a Fitbit for seniors.
Oh, that's fascinating. I'm excited to hear about that. In fact, you've really introduced to me two potential fitness revolutions. Like you, I've been very interested in the future of health and fitness. That's kind of the area that I focus on. And I've written about sarcopenia and that disease's prominence in the mindset of boomers in the future. That is the goal, not to lose muscle mass due to aging. And this kind of technology could be fascinating in terms of helping people really identify changes in their physical condition that they might not otherwise notice.
Exactly. And it's so small and easy to put on. You know, at this point, when I notice that I'm not wearing it, I go look for it. I've been self-trained. And I think that's the key thing about devices like this. It's not interventionist in my life in any way, although when you put it on in the morning, it says, "Go, Lori."
Wow.
And I like the flower idea. It keeps adding flowers to this stalk, you know, if I actually, you know, get out there and walk for longer.
That's amazing.
Unfortunately, it's not waterproof, and I do water aerobics, and so I can't take it into the pool. So it's not counting any of my pool time. Which, you know, someday there'll be a device that's waterproof that will notice that I'm jumping up and down in a class with a bunch of other people.
Well, for our discriminating and listeners who are paying attention, I've heard about four or five business opportunities already this with our conversation. So let me switch the gear a little bit because, again, I'm just trying to get this high-level overview of some of the things you're thinking about. And one of the areas that you have written and commented about is technology and age-friendly cities. What technologies may be involved in making cities more age-friendly? And can you give any examples of any city out there that kind of gets it?
Well, I think the most age-friendly thing that you could see in cities, aside from the ability to easily get off the curb onto the crosswalk, is the changing walk times. I don't know if you've noticed this in some cities. Some cities, it looks like you have to basically run across the street to get across in time for the amount of pedestrian time that's allowed to get there. In other cities, it's being lengthened. I know New York City, some parts of New York City, they're trying to lengthen it. In Toronto, they're trying to lengthen it. And to the degree that people are adjusting the walk times for pedestrians, which is all, you know, all they have to do is just change their devices. But that's an example of a way in which a city can become more age-friendly. The ramps for motorized chairs to be able to go up and you know, get off the curb and on the curb, that's a sign of age-friendliness. The degree to which there is good quality public transportation with decent elevators, escalators that work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ironic sometimes to go to Washington, D.C., which actually has a magnificent metro system, but signs everywhere telling you that if you're going to take the metro to this particular station, the elevator is out.
Yes.
Which is a message to people who are disabled. They can't get off at that station. You know, they're going to have to get off at a different station because there's no way they're going to be able to take their motorized chair up an elevator. Now, to me, you know, it's great that they have these signs, but it's really unfortunate that so many of them are not working. But that's, yeah, to me, an age-friendly. So the ability to get across the street, the ability to get on and off sidewalks, the ability to have public transportation systems that actually are viable for getting in and out of them, these are all signs of age-friendliness where people can live there as long as they want. Then, of course, you need all the other services, the ability to have access to nearby shopping. Right now, in a lot of places, transportation doesn't look too attractive, which is why something like the International Transportation Network, I don't know if you're familiar with ITN, but that's a grassroots movement that's actually forming in a number of locations around the country to create volunteers who actually will drive you around in your own car. You know, you don't have to necessarily throw your car out. The volunteer network includes the use of your car.
Isn't that interesting? That's fascinating. I think I got the impression from what you wrote, though, Lori, that you weren't overly enamored of the accomplishments of most of our metropolitan areas in terms of really starting to re-gear their thinking and therefore their technology solutions to accommodate a country in which almost every major city is going to look like a lot like Sarasota, you know, mm-hmm, with a heavy population of aging adults. Is that kind of where you are still? Are you feeling like we're behind the curve here?
We're behind the curve. Part of the issue is that it's done in such a fragmented way. It varies from city to city. There's sort of an international age-friendly city self-identification that a city can do, but it's really up to the individual cities to look at their populations and decide if they need to do anything. It's not uniform, and I don't really feel that people have figured out standards for it. The senior center, for example, is such a local thing. So many of them have been closed in so many places because of lack of funds. You really need places for folks to congregate. You need a way for them to get there. You need their ability to be able to shop appropriately, to stay in their homes if they wish to. Everybody is not going to want to move to assisted living. And many people will not be able to afford to move to assisted living. The average age in assisted living right now in the United States is 86 years old. There's just no way that's a solution for many of the people.
As a matter of fact, I want to explore that specific area of assisted living a little more in our conversation. And also, when we come back from this break, I want to talk to you more, Lori, about an important statistic that has caused me to think and consider implications. And that is that uniquely the boomer generation, almost 20% did not have children. And that's double the GI generation, which not only are we going to have a lot more aging adults, but we're going to have a lot more aging adults with zero children to look in on the caregiving process, whether actively or passively. So when we come back, I'm going to talk with Lori more about this, because that has vast implications for everything related to age tech. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Be sure to join us at fmguniversity.com. That's where we can turn your passion into business within 30 days, put some fun back into your life, show you how to make money, and do good for yourself and others. That's why we are called FMG, Fun Money Good. Get started today. Go to fmguniversity.com.
Lori, a lot of the information that I read, news reports and what have you, point to the idea that part of the growth of caregiving involves children having an opportunity to keep their eye on their parents, but not necessarily physically close to their parents. That is remote monitoring and things like that. And, you know, for example, at the 2005 White House Conference on Aging, I was absolutely awestruck by what Intel was doing as an example of creating technology so that in a non-intrusive way, a child in San Francisco could keep pretty careful eye on the parent in Topeka, Kansas, who is living on their own but is needing oversight, so to speak. So we know about those technologies developing, but I'm interested to know, again, I quoted the statistic that 19% of boomers had zero children, and if you add additionally the boomers that only had one child, we're now talking 36% of the generation, zero or one child, which changes the caregiving model that exists today, where there might be 3 to 4 boomer children able to keep an eye on the GI generation mom and dad. From a technology watch point of view, what kind of things do you think about when you think about those kinds of statistics?
Well, there's sort of two dimensions of it. One, I think, is the growth of home care. The fastest growing two job categories, or two of the fastest growing job categories in the United States right now, are companion aid, home companion aid, and home health aid. And I think this points to the boom in home care as a preferred means of aging in your own home, in comparison to going to assisted living or a nursing home. And maybe it's a more affordable means to be visited a couple times a week by a home care aide, as opposed to the average cost of assisted living in the United States, which I think is $41,000 a year. So that's one dimension. I think we will engage home care as we need it over time. The other thing I think that's pretty interesting is the growth of social networks in general. I imagine a time, there's an example of this that happened actually in Boston this past year around snow shoveling. It turns out that there was quite a pile of snow deposited last February or January in the Boston city streets, and it was through Facebook that a little network of teenagers was corralled to actually shovel the sidewalks of aging people on the street. It was all done through basically a social network effort, and the kids got organized, and they went and basically shoveled out their neighbors. Now, to me, the idea of a neighborhood that includes a little bit of, who are my neighbors, what is the ability for us to actually mutually support each other. So, maybe I could provide something to a neighbor that had a young teenager in the home, and maybe if I needed support, a young person could help me out. That to me the forming of networks, whether they're social networks of your peers or social networks of your street and your community. A lot of people are looking at the possibility in the future of social networks really becoming more robust around churches or synagogues. There's lots of ways we can offer and find support, and I think a lot of that is going to come from outside, you know, the sort of traditional nuclear family.
Yeah, I would certainly suspect that, and maybe the technology that will enable that for neighbors who may not know each other to get to know each other might actually occur online first, even though physically they're very closely located next near each other. So maybe that's a possibility. You know, Forrester Research, your former employer, has projected that in-home medical monitoring, which is just, of course, one facet of this burgeoning age tech industry, could reach $34 billion by 2015 as the leading edge of the boomer generation begins to approach age 70. So obviously related to what you were just talking about is in-home medical monitoring. And I'm kind of curious what you believe are the kinds of in-home medical monitoring that may become ubiquitous and create this kind of revenue that Forrester is projecting.
Yeah, well, I think one dimension is going to be a better, we're going to see better versions of medication dispensing and monitoring, because one thing we know is that medication noncompliance, that is when people don't take their medications appropriately or mismanage their doses, they become at risk of fluctuations in blood pressure that potentially cause one to be more likely to fall. So what we really want to do is we want to prevent falling in the home, and you can do one thing about fixing the floors and the rugs and the dangerous areas in the bathroom and what have you with grab bars and so forth, but you can also make sure that if people are on medications to help them with certain kinds of conditions that they take those medications. And so reminders, medication reminders, pre-configured dosage devices that meter out the appropriate amount of medications that only have to be loaded, you know, periodically, in which someone is notified if you don't take the medication. All of those kinds of, so medication is one dimension. Certainly chronic disease monitoring for the most frequent reasons for readmission to the hospital. So, you know, weight scales for congestive heart failure. Potentially there'll be better home-based diabetes self-test kits, and then communication of your status in terms of diabetes.
So those things you believe
blood pressure
will be
cuffs, right? Electronic blood pressure cuffs.
Mm-hmm. And you're believing, again, in the context of my question, that these will become what we might say is commonplace as examples of the technology that didn't exist 10 years ago, but people will have these in their homes, or they will be built into their homes in some ways.
Yes.
And that's going to create the kind of market momentum to reach $34 billion by 2015.
Yeah. Well, the telehealth market itself has been growing, you know, slowly but steadily over the past, you know, 10 years with basically the ability to manage certain conditions in the home using technology. But it's been given a big boost recently. One aspect has to do with the penalty on doctors and hospitals if you're readmitted within 30 days for the same diagnosis that you departed the hospital with. That's being measured right now in reports on hospitals and doctor performance. And I think it's by this coming fall that those penalties will actually be calculated, and it will affect the reimbursement of Medicare, for example, to the doctor and to the hospital. So that's a factor. Also, when the doctor prescribes a certain amount of telehealth because you've been discharged with a certain chronic condition and you need to be monitored for a certain later incentive on the part of the healthcare community to extend the number of days that you actually have in-home monitoring, technology-based monitoring, as a way of avoiding, you know, in-home visits from nurses or having you readmitted to the hospital. All of that I think is going to factor in the future. I mean, in some countries right now, in Australia, the reimbursement rate for doctors for remote telehealth visits is higher than the face-to-face visit reimbursement. In the U.S., that's the reverse. Right now, we reimburse more in insurance programs, we reimburse more for face-to-face visits than we do for telehealth. When that is switched in the U.S. the way it has been switched in Australia, then you're going to see a lot more in-home medical monitoring.
I see. You know, one of the things, and I think this might be a little more futuristic, and it doesn't necessarily apply to people as they're aging, but I'm wondering if you've read or given any thought to, I have heard that the commode, that is the throne, may in fact someday become a chemistry lab that measures our output, so to speak, and from it can recognize disease conditions that are forming or changes in disease conditions that could lead to life-threatening consequences. Are you seeing any of that kind of technology starting to emerge? Because that's fascinating. Do your business and suddenly somebody is calling you and saying, you need to get into the hospital right now.
Yeah, that technology I think has been invented. Uh-huh. I think it'll probably be pioneered first in Japan, probably with the Toto toilet people who are really innovative in terms of their designs and what have you. I don't know, is that the best way to find out that you really need to come to the hospital right now? It may be that there's a better way. The very important things to think about all of these technologies is we personally must opt in to their use. We do not want to have any technology monitoring us against our wishes or without our knowledge. And when you start to think about, you know, what possible invasions of privacy that can occur in your home, there's a long list of opportunities, but we must opt into them. We don't want people ripping devices out of the wall, throwing them in the trash, or trying to avoid the bathroom that has the smart toilet.
Well, hear, hear. And I appreciate your saying that. That's very much on my mind. I have a close friend, an attorney, that is writing a book about the extent to which our privacy is being invaded today at levels that most of us may not even be aware of. So, yeah, biomedical monitoring has its dark side in that it might prevent employment. It might, there could be all kinds of consequences that we justifiably might fear. So thanks for throwing that cautionary note out there. I'm excited about technology and its potential to eliminate some of the human caretaking factor, which I guess is necessary to manage our future medical costs. But I'm also concerned that I'd like to have some privacy in my life too.
Right.
Joe Coughlin, who is somebody that you have mentioned previously in the conversation, he is the director of the MIT Age Lab. He wrote something that you connected with, and I quote, "No profession has emerged to be the advisor on what older adults or their families need or should buy." Now, that seems like a very good point to me, and dovetailing a lot of what you're involved in. What are your reactions to that comment? Is that a career in the making, perhaps, as a way of asking that question?
Well, what frustrates me a little bit about the current world of services that are offered to older adults, let's just take, for example, geriatric care managers or home care agencies. And I'll start with geriatric care managers. These organizations are filled with people who care very much about older adults and making sure they have good care. And they often talk about the fact that technology could be beneficial in helping to keep people longer in their homes of choice. But they themselves resist recommending any specific technology. So if you want to know what vendors could actually help you with remote monitoring of chronic disease, today you really can't ask a geriatric care manager. They're not going to be able to tell you, and they actually think it's a little bit of a conflict of interest for them to be mentioning vendor names. And yet, really, when you think about it, there is nothing you can do in your life for which, ultimately, if you wish to buy something or acquire something to help you do it, it all boils down to who are you going to buy it from, How much is it going to cost? And, you know, is it a trusted vendor and a trusted device? So we really need a lot more energy applied to testing and publicizing the efficacy of technologies for use in the home. Sometimes the vendors are small vendors, and the very first couple versions of the product they make, you know, has bugs. It doesn't work. That's not That's not good. We want to have a lot more interest. I want to see Consumer Reports jump back into the topic of remote monitoring of chronic disease and remote monitoring of older adults. They were in it for a little while, about 5 years ago, and then they dropped out and they said, oh, you know, we just can't really deal with this. I want to see senior housing organizations test and endorse specific technologies. I just want to see a lot more effort to certify. I know AARP is contemplating putting together some kind of certification effort. If anybody ought to do it, it should be AARP.
Absolutely. Well, do you think that there might be a aging tech manager, like a care manager occupation appear in the next few years where, you know, it's kind of like the analog to the Geek Squad that Best Buy has that you can call on, you know, you're a child of parents who are obviously staying in the home but need a range of technologies that will escalate over time in terms of the extent to which they monitor and manage the older person's daily activities. Do you see that kind of an occupation emerging, perhaps?
I do see ways in which it's sort of being assembled right now. So if you look at a lot of people who had previously were in the IT field, some of them are retired. Some of them are out doing their own little businesses around, you know, PC support or setting up home networks and efforts like that. Now, to me, I see a perfect alliance between geriatric care managers, senior housing, Best Buy type geek squads, and all of these people who go into the home security people who put in home alarms, and PC support people and, you know, home people who set up home networks. If you just created a little ring of those businesses in every, you know, well-populated area, you would solve a lot of issues.
That's fascinating. Well, we're going to take a final break, and as is typical for this show, at least for me, and I hope for you, our listeners, I have more questions than we have time, and that's why one thing I will encourage you to do, and I'll give you this URL a second time at the end of the show, is to go to Lori's website, which is a portal to the age technology and everything about it, and that's ageinplacetech.com. I'm going to ask her when we come back her feelings about the future of assisted living facilities as we know it today, because I posed that thought in a speech a week ago and got a bit of a surprising reaction. So hang on, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
Lori, last week I gave a couple of speeches in Colorado Springs, and in one of the workshops, I kind of survey where I think the business opportunities are going to be, and that's pretty much to counter the gloom and doom views of the future of aging, where everything is going to be horrible because 78 million baby boomers are going to get old. And one of the areas that I mentioned is the possibility, because of your domain of expertise and what's happening in age technology, that maybe the traditional assisted living community home, if you will, is on the endangered species list for the long term. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts about that might be.
Well, when you have an average age in assisted living today of 86, you can see that people have put off moving in, and in the independent living portions of continuing care retirement communities, the age, average age, I believe, is moving up. It's probably now in the low 80s or high 70s.
Amazing.
So we're not talking about people, you know, hopping in there in their 50s, like the so-called 55-plus communities that are all over the country.
Yes.
You know, I think the problem with 55, I have sort of concerns in both directions. The problem with 55-plus communities is everybody sort of ages in them and needs more services, and there are no young people around to provide those services, and no young people around, period, because it's a 55-plus minimum age range. And if you look at the villages in Florida, which has 80,000 people in 55-plus communities, they've actually built a school there to accommodate the children of workers, because it's in the middle of nowhere and there's otherwise no schools for them to go to. So that's, on the one hand, I think the 55-plus community is was an idea that came, and I would think that intergenerational communities would be better for everybody in the long run. If you look at assisted living and the price of it, so the average price of assisted living in the United States right now is $41,000, and that's across the whole country. That doesn't say in really high-end urban areas that $41,000 would even do it. So the question is, how do you move into assisted living at a younger age than age 86 and fund it from the sale of a house when the average sale price of a home in the United States right now, I think, is around $169,000?
Huh,
we've got all those years of assisted living unable to be funded by the private sale of homes. So what I think the solution in the future is, first of all, I think the assisted living world, the continuing care retirement communities and for-profit assisted living are going to start looking at extending their services out into the geography in which they sit. I think they will find two things will happen as a result of that. One is they will create themselves as sort of a hub for activities and potentially even fee-based activities and services to people who are still living in their home. And maybe they create a pipeline for people who have conditions that really don't warrant staying in your own home anymore. Dementia, by the way, being one of those conditions.
Yes.
So, you know, and then there's some organizations, and I met this company called the Evangelical Homes of Michigan as one example, in which instead of being 80% focused on brick-and-mortar building-based services and 20% on services into the community, this particular organization is trying to reverse it to be 80% focused on services into the community and only 20% on brick-and-mortar buildings.
That's interesting.
That migration will continue.
Right. And I was just thinking about the infrastructure investments that the assisted living industry has and have wondered whether or not, and to some extent, their product will go the way of Blockbuster Video, and that people will skip from in-home care to possibly skilled care and move and eliminate the intervening steps such as independent living and assisted living. I guess that question will be something the industry is going to talk about a lot. Well, let me ask you a couple of quick more questions, Lori. This is a very fascinating discussion to me. What's different about the way boomers will experience old age in your judgment, and how might they use adaptive technologies better to function independently, so to speak? What's different generationally?
Well, I think we're a generation that will preserve our independence until the last gasp, and therefore we will probably fight to we're either going to fight to stay in our own homes, or we're going to go find communities that will be ones that we enjoy living in. You know, maybe we'll want to live near colleges and continue to take courses. I met a retired gentleman in Pittsburgh recently who told me he was taking 6 hours a day of courses at Carnegie Mellon in his retirement. Yeah, that's what he wanted to do. And so maybe some people, you know, in their 60s and 70s will find locations to live in where they'll get the kind of stimulation that they had in their younger years. It won't all be, I think, about golf and, you know, this traditional view of sort of retirement communities that we've had in the past. That's one thing. And I think the other thing is that, you know, boomers, I also think we want to work. I think the one thing that characterizes boomers, we don't necessarily want to work at the jobs we used to work at, but we like to earn money. And I think boomers are going to work at something longer, possibly just a few hours a week, possibly like the pharmacist for CVS I read about last year, very, very interesting, where you can be a pharmacist for CVS 6 months of the year in the north and 6 months of the year in Florida. And, you know, you just basically migrate with the weather and keep your job. I mean, that's one approach. And then the other approach is, you know, new forms of work, new part-time jobs will be created that will enable us to continue to do some form of work, partly because our life expectancy is going to be far longer than it has ever been for this age groups in the past. And, you know, will we outlive our income? That'd be one, and our savings. That's one question. And partly because work is stimulating to the mind.
Okay. And I guess I want to ask one final question. It's more a little bit about what you're doing and that what are you doing to plan, I guess, for your own adaptive technology needs. You mentioned Fitbit earlier in the conversation, which is kind of a, I'd call a precursor technology. What are you going to be doing to fortify your technology arsenal for Lori Orlov?
Well, my husband and I moved out of a 3,400 square foot, two-story home on a scary driveway in Massachusetts. We moved to a one-story home in Florida 5 years ago. So one thing I did was our house is entirely on one level. That's our primary home and the home we plan to be in until we have to drive our car over to the nearby assisted living. So that's one thing. We also have great home alarm system here that is not at the moment activated to really do much and notify anybody, but it could be. We have the ability to place grab bars and walking bars and what have you in the home that I know people in my neighborhood who've done that. So the home is modifiable, and it's an appropriate home to live in on one story, which I think is very key. And, of course, I have every form of communication technology in the home that you could possibly want. You know, I've got computers and headsets and conference phones and a television that could be made interactive. And, it'd be hard for me to feel super isolated with all the tech, unless the power goes out.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I very much enjoyed it. As I said at the beginning, I'm kind of a technology geek myself, but I have so much to learn, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and get a much deeper understanding about the potential for technology in changing the way we age.
Well, I thank you so much for having me on the program, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, again, we'll keep following your work. And for those of you listening again, if you want to learn about the future of aging with respect to technologies, adaptive technologies, assistive technologies, and particular how those technologies will be embraced and changed by the boomer generation, then by all means, visit Lori's website and blog frequently. And it's called Age in Place Tech. .com, ageinplacetech.com. And if that doesn't work, try Google. As always, thanks for your interest in our show. And you may post your comments and questions on my Facebook page, which is facebook.com and Brent Green Denver. Or you can follow me and send direct messages on Twitter. And you can follow me at Boomer Marketing. And peek in on my blog. I've now been writing it for 6 years, and I continue the conversation about the boomer future, and that's boomers.typepad.com. I do appreciate your being with us today. I hope you'll come back and listen to our future shows. There's quite an archive. Lori Orlov was my 51st show, so there's quite a knowledge bank available to you. And always, we have one thing in common among all these shows, and that's to talk about and speculate about a worldwide boomer revolution discussed here weekly called Generation Reinvention.
You've been listening to Generation Reinvention with your host, Brent Green. Visit Brent at his website at generationreinvention.com And for archive shows, be sure to visit his show page here on the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is, have fun, make money.